Welcome to Power of the Tribe podcast. I'm your host, John Connors. I'm also the founder and head instructor of Connors Martial Arts here in Norwood, Massachusetts. We teach Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, grappling. Some people call it grappling, Dan. Muay Thai, kickboxing, and mixed martial arts. Yeah, grappling. It's like grappling, but more grabbing.
A lot of grabbing. Yeah.
I know two people who call grappling, grappling.
You know, two people?
Two people. Maria's sister and the woman who cuts my hair. She says, do you do grappling or jiu-jitsu? I said, I do it all.
Yeah. Grappling, jiu-jitsu, and a little grappling.
A little grappling. And I'm here with Dan Robin. How you doing, Dan?
I'm doing good.
We're going to name the podcast The Grabbler and the Kid.
Yeah.
And you're the kid. What do you think?
Grabbler and the Kid. Yeah, we need a more interesting name, a more catchy name of the podcast.
Yeah.
I was thinking about Power of the Tribe recently, and
yeah,
like maybe the podcast listener should be the tribe now at
this point,
as opposed to like your gym set, you know, or...
I think they are, Dan. That's a good point. Yeah.
Right. This is the tribe. If you're listening, you are the tribe.
Join our tribe and and improve your life. 37.8%.
Become a grabbler. Have we zeroed in on how much it improves your life?
Well, that's a good question, Dan.
And that's another point. You always said... improve your life by, you know, by coming to the gym or trying Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. Now we're saying just listen to the podcast.
Yeah, screw coming to the gym.
And that alone is like at least a 30 to 40% improvement on your life.
I think you got it. I think it's right in there. I think 20% isn't going to get people excited enough. I think something above 35% is credible.
But this is a minimum.
But yes.
That's a minimum. It could improve 100%.
Good.
200%.
Yeah.
You know, there's almost no upper limit, but at least 35%. And that's proven. We've done studies. I don't want to go into it because I feel like the listeners would be bored by all the science.
We've done extensive research. Yeah, I don't want to get too technical.
We don't talk about confidence intervals and, you know, p-values.
None of it's been reproduced, but I'll put it right up there with most social psychological experiments done in the last 30 years. I'll put our research right next to it.
35% and up improvement to your life just by listening to the podcast. That's the new take. We're not even saying you need to train.
Yeah. You don't have to do anything. Just listen.
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't have to eat healthy. Nothing. Just listen.
That's a pretty good
rate and review and tell people about the podcast.
Well, then it's, you know, for the people that rate and review, preliminary results show 50% and up improvement of your life if you're one of the people that rates and reviews.
Definitely. Decreased waist circumference, increased sexual activity, without a doubt.
Right.
For everyone who recommends and shares.
More charisma. You have more to talk about. You seem more learned.
You are more learned.
Yeah, you actually, you are more learned. It's not just seem.
I like that word, learned.
Yeah.
And you get that Power of the Tribe swag.
Exactly.
That's swagger.
Grappling, and what were you going to rename it?
The Grabbler and the Kid.
And the Kid, so am I you're the Grabbler, I'm the Kid?
I think I'm the Grabbler, yeah, and you're the Kid. Yeah,
okay.
You look so youthful since you've been part of the tribe. Yeah,
Grabbler and the Kid. Well, welcome to Grabbler and the Kid. Welcome to our tribe.
Our tribe, yep.
And are we going to get right into the main topic?
What's the main topic today, Dan?
Is your results from last weekend.
From the IBJJF.
Let me tell you something.
World Championships.
And maybe this is sort of like... it's a strange sort of intro, but I was reading, I think it was a Tim Ferriss thing, and he was interviewing some author, a woman who wrote, I don't remember what she wrote, author, and it was saying, what is the recipe for success? Like, you know, there's a million recipes for success, right? You always hear, I mean, there's a, you know, people are always talking about that. She was saying the closest thing we've ever found is consistency with, and motivated by a love for the work.
Hmm.
Consistency, motivated by a love for the work. So all this is by way of intro in your last weekend, which I believe for a year now, you've dedicated yourself like with great consistency. And I would say with a love for jiu-jitsu and with a goal in mind. And your goal was?
I would say 18 months, but otherwise 18 months. Spot on. Yep.
Right. So, or do you want to talk through? Like,
no, okay. I like it what you're doing.
And yeah. Your goal, you came in, you hadn't competed since, some people said 10 years, but I think it was longer.
Dan, I took 18 and a half years away. So I competed in April of 2000.
What was it? Of 2000.
Of 2000.
I thought you were going to say 2000 and no. You're just like, you stopped.
Flat 2000. I was a blue belt. I won my division at the Pan Ams. BJ Penn was competing, and he got thrown out of the tournament for slapping a guy in the face in his match.
I think I've seen that video.
Yeah. I think the guy's name was Neto, and he was a very good jiu-jitsu
competitor. He's a famous
competitor.
Guy now, isn't he?
I don't know. I'm not sure, but he was, at the time, he was a top guy. Yeah, it was in the black belt, and that was a hotly contested match. Something happened, and they started, and I think BJ Penn slapped him somehow.
And it was like an ancient, like BJ, was he even an MMA fighter back then, or?
That's a great question. I think it might have been right before he started fighting, yeah.
So it was ancient days.
Yeah.
Sort of a strange thing for you to step away, actually.
Yes, yeah.
Right? Yep. Like to do well.
Yeah.
And then, as a quick aside, do you have any memory of why you stepped away? You just didn't feel like doing it again, or too much anxiety, or too much pressure?
I had a lot of anxiety, Dan, actually. That is a good point. So we went down to Florida. It was in Kissimmee, right? Kissimmee, Florida. It's outside of Orlando. And we were down there for a few days. And the 2 days preceding the contest, I had just crushing anxiety. Awful. And I remember thinking, this is just the worst. Why the hell am I doing this? I didn't really have any tactics or methodology right. to deal with it either.
So we've talked about that quite a bit on here. And yeah. What's always interesting to me is I think interesting to a lot of people that know you that listen to this podcast is that you don't seem like someone that would have, you know, anxiety. You seem like you'd be pretty steady.
I didn't have any degradation in my performance, really.
Right. But I think it's interesting for people to know that you had anxiety because right. I think, you know, a lot of people that have anxiety are sort of feel like they're surrounded by people that don't.
Mm.
You know what I mean? They feel like their opponent mm-hmm. doesn't. They feel like their teammates don't. And a lot of people talk that way too. They're like, I feel great. I can't. You know, you hear people say, the MMA fighters saying, I wake up when I like getting punched in the face. Mm. And then competitors are like, well, I don't like getting punched in the face. Mm. And they feel like they're different. Mm. Or they feel like, you know, people like, I just get excited. I love it. And they feel like they're different. They're like, well, I'm nervous. So it's interesting and I think valuable for people to know. You don't know who's...
You don't. And I think...
Even the people that win maybe right. have crushing anxiety. Yeah. We've talked about it a bit yeah. on here too.
I think everyone is essentially born with a different nervous system that operates in different ways. And so a lot of people can be burdened with a nervous system that gives them more anxiety than is useful. And I came up with this... sort of little mantra from that is you are not your nervous yeah. system, you know? And another point, Dan, given the proper circumstances, almost anybody can feel fear and anxiety.
Right.
And even the toughest guys in the world. I think of, what was the guy's name? Michael Spinks.
Right.
So Michael Spinks, these numbers are going to rattle off the top of my head, Dan. Could be incorrect, but they're close. He was a gold medal winner, undefeated as an amateur boxer. He was world champion. Light heavyweight. I believe he was something like 28-0, undefeated, right. Dan, right?
I remember he was Leon Spinks' younger brother.
Yep. Never knocked out. I don't think ever knocked down, maybe. Excellent boxer. Excellent competitor. He signed a fight to fight Mike Tyson. I think he got a huge payday just to show up. They didn't do that. Here's the show. Here's the win. I think he made like $8 million back in the 80s or something. Right. Early 90s. I don't know when the hell it was. Probably the late 80s.
80s, I think.
Yeah. And he went out there and he looked terrified. I'm like,
yeah.
Huh.
I think he admitted to being terrified.
Yeah. And here you get a guy that is at the highest level of competence.
And he's been
for
in there
field.
Against killers, right?
I mean, he fought Larry Holmes, who's right. bigger than Tyson and like another excellent boxer and fighter, powerful guy. And for whatever reason, Mike Tyson pushed all the buttons. And made him terrified. Yeah.
Yeah.
I found that fascinating.
I remember it was the pay-per-view, Mike Tyson fighting prior to the Mike, when everyone was talking about him fighting Spinks.
Uh-huh.
Do you remember this? And they showed Spinks like he, on purpose, like they showed him in like the back row of the arena, and he was like sort of laughing, saying, yeah, I think he might have said like, this is as close as I want to get to Tyson, like sitting yeah. like up in the bleachers.
Yeah.
You know, he was standing in the bleachers, and I think he might have been joking and saying that, like, this yeah. is as close as I want to get. But yeah, Tyson got really in his head.
Yeah. And he lasted like 90 seconds, I think, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it was a big weapon of Tyson's where that happened to a lot of his opponents, right? Like in
a lot of guys were beat before they got in there. Yeah. Definitely.
Holyfield wasn't, Evander Holyfield, who eventually beat him, wasn't scared at all.
He wasn't having any of that. Yeah.
And he outclassed him, really.
Yeah.
And then, and when he did lose to Buster Douglas also wasn't scared because he got on this mission because his mother had died.
Yeah.
And so it seemed like a big weapon of Tyson's was getting people to feel anxiety yeah. by getting in there.
I think so. Buster Douglas broke the spell.
Yeah.
It was like everyone was under a magic spell, and he broke it. And yeah. then the kind of the floodgates opened, I think, after that.
So for you, you stopped competing. Was there some pressure where people like, John, you're pretty good. You might want to compete at Purple Belt?
I'll say this, Dan. Very funny that you should say that. So I had done a fair amount of tournaments as a white belt, maybe as a blue belt. I was competing with a lot of frequency and a lot of success. And then this idea, there's a Pan Am. So I said, there's a Pan Am championship. Oh, could I do that? Yeah. You can be a blue belt and compete in it. And I was like, oh, maybe I should do that. And a fair number of us from Boston Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu Academy, Roberto Maia, of course, is the professor, head instructor. He went and competed. I believe Kenny Florian and Keith Florian probably went and competed. I think Dan McCarthy did. A bunch of different guys. I can't think off the top of my head. I'm sure I'll skip half of them. But a bunch of people, probably a dozen or so guys, went down there to compete. So one of the guys they had back then, this is pre-World Wide Web, Dan. But what they did have, I guess you'd say pre-World Wide Web, but they had a bulletin board. So it's pre-Facebook, yeah. pre-social media. So what you have is you would have your Boston Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu bulletin board where people would post stuff up there. And so sort of like an early version of Facebook that people would have. And you would log in and you could read and post on it. And somebody posted, and I was training really hard and sparring with everybody. And I had good takedowns. So if I sparred with the higher belts, like the brown belts and the black belts, I could take them down.
Right.
And then they would immediately armbar me and almost break my arm. But I could score 2 points. And somebody went on that forum and wrote, John Connors is going to win the Pan Ams. I guarantee it. And I was like, son of a bitch. I didn't know it then, but it felt awful when they wrote that. And now I know they've put me firmly in the ego trap by right. doing that. And it's somebody else did it, Dan. I didn't do it to myself.
Yeah.
And that probably led to a lot of the pressure. Definitely. Yeah.
And it did. You think it led to you not wanting to compete? Like,
no, Dan, to be honest, I had a lot of stuff going on in my life.
Right.
A lot
right.
of turmoil. I ended up getting divorced. I had sort of issues with my family, but mostly that. So that became too big of a distraction.
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, we've said that about training as well. It's a whole other topic, which you don't, but like a lot, if things go on in your life that can distract from training for a million different reasons, you see it all the time,
right?
Like real life gets in the way. You manage to keep training, but I could see being like, I don't need the extra.
I couldn't do it. Yeah. Yeah. It's like when people are ghosting you, right? That woman who ghosted you, she went through a divorce. And right. that was probably the same thing. Like you're in so much emotional pain and turmoil. You're just like, I just got to find a way to get through to today. You know right. what I mean? Yeah.
So 18 years off.
18 and a half.
And we talked about this before, so I don't want to, you know, we're real quick, but you felt like you were in this ego trap where you're the instructor, head instructor at a gym.
Yeah.
Owner of the gym. And people saying you're good and you could win and you're...
So to be clear, the ego trap is something that's in the individual's own mind. So okay. they're perceived in their mind that they're being overvalued by the people around them. And so therefore, if they go to compete, they're risking losing esteem and they can't gain any more
right.
esteem
because right. they're already overvalued. They could do nothing and everyone thinks they're great. So you exactly. might as well do nothing.
That's the reasonable response. Do nothing.
I mean,
definitely.
And that is... completely the number one dominant mentality of a lot of the martial, like the martial arts where you don't have to compete. Like someone's like, the grandmaster.
Yeah.
And you get, that's like the stereotype of the guy with the big pot belly that comes in. They're like, he's a killer. Yeah. I heard he could kill, and he never has to do anything.
Yeah.
Never wants to do anything.
Never will do anything.
Yeah. Yeah. And doesn't even want to, like, I've seen that from way, way back when in my karate days, where they'd be like, I don't even want to show a punch. Like, I don't want to show anything,
right?
Because people will be like, that's it. You know what I mean? Like, they don't even want to be like, watch me break a board, or like, watch me just throw a punch in the air, because people would be like, that looked like a normal punch. Like,
right. You'd have to break 100 boards.
Right, right.
You'd have to do something far above and beyond what anybody else
is doing.
So
they end up swaggering around like, but it's all based on insecurity and based on like, I can't show anything. So for something like Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, it's not as bad because you are proving yourself. You are going out there on the mat and you are rolling.
You are, but there's still a temptation to dial it back and not train hard and not train with the best people too. You know
right.
What I mean?
Are there certain people where you're like, I don't really want to train with them?
I remember years ago, I asked one of my college buddies. I was like, yeah, I'm in this place. This is probably 10 years ago, Dan. Maybe I'm like, I'm rolling hard with all these guys and it's getting really challenging for me. And I feel like one of these guys is going to tap me, is going to get over on me. But I'm trying to keep up and trying to keep ahead of everything. What do you think I should do? And my buddy goes, oh, you should stop training with all those guys. So he was like advocating, go completely into the ego trap, right. get into your comfort zone. And
you should walk around like with your hands clasped behind your back every class, like looking at people and maybe walking up and being like tapping people and saying, get your hand, giving advice. And
right. Turn that 2 degrees this way. Yeah. So I just intuitively knew that was the wrong advice. So I didn't take that advice.
So he was helpful.
It was helpful.
You're like, thank you. You gave me the exact wrong advice.
And it's clear now that I got to do the opposite of what you just told me. Yeah.
So it's helpful advice.
It was. Dan, that you're joking, but that actually is helpful, right?
Right?
When you get the completely wrong advice, you're like, oh, right.
You'd be a great friend if he always gives you completely wrong advice. You could ask him, call him all the time and hear what he has to say and then be like, all right, that's obviously
just do the
wrong.
Complete He's opposite.
But it is tough. But also, it's for most people that train, it's sort of interesting to me to even hear where you're like, someone might tap me. And I'm like, for most of us, it's like we're tapped all the time.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's sort of like, and I bet there's people in the gym now, though, that they got themselves to a point where they don't get tapped that much anymore. And then they fall into it. Like you work your way gradually into an ego trap, right? Where you're like,
that's true, Dan.
Where you're like, you used to get tapped all the time and you were like, had no ego trap. You get better and better and you're like, now I don't want to anymore. Or the slight version of it where you're like, I don't want to go with that blue belt because that blue belt might tap me. He's like, he's awesome and he's 26 and
full of energy,
stronger than me.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I don't want to go with that person. And that's how you work your way in, right? Like a little bit
slip into it. Yeah, that's a good point.
Because I bet when you were white belt starting out, you didn't care at all who tapped you, right? You were sort of like,
well, you can't be in an ego trap because nobody's overvaluing you.
Right.
You're a freaking white belt.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
So there's freedom in that. And in fact, I remember feeling that some of the most fun jiu-jitsu was as a white belt where you're like, nothing matters. Like I could show up at the open mat at Boston Brazilian and be like, so people are tapping me. Who cares? I'm brand new, you know? And then you get to blue belt and suddenly you're like, I'm not supposed to be bad. You know, I'm not supposed to lose to a white belt. I'm not supposed to have people saying like, you're supposed to know things.
Yeah.
And like, you know, it's gradual where it's like, why is your posture's bad? Aren't you a blue belt? You know, all of a sudden you didn't know how to get out of that triangle. You're a blue belt. Like, you know, it slowly builds on you.
Yeah, none of those things are helping you. What popped in my mind when you were describing how you could slip into that ego trap, one of the antidotes for that is positional training. You know, so if I start training with somebody and I put myself maybe in a triangle threatening position, then I'm going to try to escape from there or even a full triangle, then there's going to be times where I have to tap.
Right.
But I can.
And you're more like you tap and you're like, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. You can mitigate the psychological pain of tapping by keeping it really focused on learning and situational that way, you know? And it's a great way to train for sure.
Right. So back to the theme.
Okay.
He didn't train for 18 and a half years.
Compete for 18 and a half years.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I believe you trained during that 18 and a half years.
You know what, Dan? And I think what served me is I did a lot of positional training from those 18 years. So I think I'm very sound at escaping bad positions, escaping the bottom of my mount and side control and this type of thing, and very good at protecting myself from submissions. So I think that gave me a really good foundation when I went back into competing, where I wasn't starting from scratch. I was starting from a really good foundation, you know?
Right. And you, again, with the escapes, you sort of feel like it's going to be really tough to tap me. Win or lose.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
The thing I never understand about, well, I could ask you about this, and I guess it's interesting to probably most of the people doing jiu-jitsu, where I almost can't conceive of, and I've mentioned this to you before, not on the podcast, where how you avoid like the new trick. Like, you know what I mean? Like, someone just has a way of like reaping the leg and doing like just something where you're like, someone has a new trick where, because I've seen people pretty high level, brown to black belt, get caught in a trick where they're like, they make it look like you can pass, but then they catch you in an arm bar or something.
Right.
Is it pure if you do everything right?
I think
no trick works, or, you know, I don't even get it. Because for me, I'm like, what did you just do? Some trick? I don't know how.
Yeah. I think if you understand the fundamentals, the principles, then tricks are harder to put on somebody, because your arms are in close to your body. You know, your posture's in a good position. Not impossible, but you stand a better chance of avoiding the traps when your fundamental principle-based jiu-jitsu is
And that includes
really
all the new leg lock stuff that it seems like lots of people are getting
around. Yeah, well, you know, a principle for submissions, Dan, is limb isolation. Your limb really has to be isolated in order for it to be submitted. So if you don't allow one of your legs to get isolated, it doesn't matter what the trick is, they're not going to be able to leg lock you.
Right.
So, I mean, an inside position is better than outside position. So if I have two butterfly hooks in on my training partner and I get either two under hooks or inside their biceps, they're not going to be able to leg lock me. They're not going to be able to do a lot of things to me. So when you understand those things, it protects you from a lot of the whatever so-called new tricks.
Right.
Yeah.
So, as people that, as all the tribe members who have been listening to our podcast know, 18 months ago, you said, I'm in this ego trap and I want to get out of it.
I want to start competing. Yeah.
Which is the way to get out of it.
Yeah.
And it's easy to sort of hindsight and be like, okay, I'll just get out of this and I'll succeed. But there's a big downside. There's a big risk, right? You could have been crushed.
It's almost all downside. That's the problem with an ego trap, that you don't see any win. All you see is loss.
I think this is true, not to broaden it a bit, but of a lot of advice people hear, all over, virtually all advice you hear is the downplaying of the downside of things. Mm. Because every story we hear is like, I gave up my job, my cushy job to start a business,
right,
and now I'm a multimillionaire. And it's like,
I took a chance and it paid off. Baby.
And that's all you hear.
All you hear.
It feels like all the chances pay off, but they don't. Right? Do you know what I mean? Like, some people give up that cushy job and now they don't have a cushy job.
What do they call that, Dan? Selection bias. So you only hear about the Cinderella stories that pay off, not the 99.9% of the ones that don't pay off. That's not an interesting story.
Right. Like, it's,
you know what? I did see one of these stories. Mm-hmm. So I watched on the plane, a documentary, it must be on Netflix, about DeLorean, the guy that made the car. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly it, Dan. He took a chance. He swung for the fences and he ended up in jail because he was a nut and a kook and a crook. But it was fascinating to watch that, because it's exactly what you say, Dan. He was like, he's a risk taker and there's no upside without a lot of risk. And he was talking all that game, and it worked for him to a large extent. So he took over the Pontiac division of General Motors, which at that time was considered a dying line. And it was like, this is the car for your grandmother, like an old, boring. But he realized there's only upside here. It's so low, it's failing so much, that if I move the needle in the right direction at all, they're going to think I'm a genius. So he went in there and he came up with the GTO. This was like a muscle car. And they fought him and everything, but he's like, you got to take a chance. And then it ended up being hugely successful, changed the whole auto industry. Other lines started making these cars, and he was a genius, you know. Genius. Because he took a big chance. Yeah. He rolled the dice once and it paid off. He flipped the coin. He called tails and landed tails. So he's a genius. So then he moves up the ranks and he's full of himself. And he gets into some tension with some of the people running General Motors. But he's in line to become president and CEO of the largest corporation in the world at the time. Right. And he says, screw you guys. I'm stepping out. I'm going to start my own automobile company. Nobody's done it since.
Because there's no greatness without risk.
And, right. All of that. Yeah. And meanwhile, he's married to the world's top supermodel. So he's basically like Tom Brady married
to
Giselle. I don't know her name off the top of my head, Dan, but it's like you're talking about the 70s. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then he adopts a boy, and then he has a girl. Then he has a baby girl with this model. So they're this perfect family. And she's like, I don't know how much younger than him. She's like 30 years younger than him. She's like 22 and he's like his late 50s or something, you know? And he's this big, tall guy. He gets a chin implant. Is that the funniest thing? Because they were showing these pictures from early in his career. I go, that's him? It doesn't look like him. He gets a chin implant. He's a big, tall guy. He's probably like 6'3". He's got this silver hair that he lets grow long. He's got his collar open all the time. He's just like this rebel. He's
70s
the man.
Yeah. Douche, it sounds like.
Yeah. And the man.
Yeah.
And he starts this company. And it struggles.
I would quickly say before we move on that like there's if you get a chin implant,
that's
there's some sort of insecurity in there. Like, I don't
know. So weird, right?
Like if you have that much success, you're like that rich and you're married to a supermodel. I don't know why you're thinking
I will say this. I think you got the chin implant before
did you get a chin implant?
No.
I don't want to even insult you. Sorry, Dimitri has a chin implant. No offense.
Dan,
yours looks fantastic,
Dan, does it look like there's been any work done here?
How do I answer that?
Actually, the chin implant kind of worked. Like when he finally had that, he looked like the character.
Work.
He looked like the character.
You can't look down on the chin implant.
No, you should look down. That is a sign that there's something fundamentally amiss with this person's personality. He was a creepy dude. So he negotiates with the government of Northern Ireland. And they start a factory. He gets government subsidies. They're building cars. He's going to build that car.
This is his own car, DeLorean.
This was the car that was in Back to the Future.
After himself, yes.
Yeah, after himself.
It's the Back to the Future car, right? It has like the doors that open, the wing doors that open to the side. Yeah, so, cool looking car.
So they make a bunch of cars. They ship them to the United States. But the thing is more expensive than a Corvette. And it runs like shit. It's not fast. It's a disaster.
It looked cool. Though.
And then he's running out of money. So they're going to shut down the plant. It's going to be over.
Yeah.
The whole, you got to take a lot of risks. It's over. So he somehow, the FBI has some informant, some totally sketchy, unethical, immoral, whack job that's a confidential informant with the FBI somehow knows him, and he goes, oh, this is great. So he goes, hey, I got some guys that might want to invest with you. So this dope goes, oh, really? And they just develop this thing where they finally convince him. He's desperate, Dan. Like they're literally in 2 weeks, we're closing your plant. It's over. And they convince him, if you just give us $2 million, it'll help us finance this big drug deal and you'll get $20 million back.
So it's total entrapment.
Total entrapment. Insane. Like there wasn't a drug dealer. There wasn't anybody but this confidential informant. And so it gets better. So first of all, what kind of idiot would think, oh, I put up $2 million and in 2 weeks I'm going to get $20 million back. Like what kind of economics is that? It's just insanity. But he fell for it because he was desperate. So then turns out he doesn't even have $2 million. And he needs like $17 million to keep the company open. Something like that. So then they go, the FBI, they're so sketchy. They get some other nut that's an FBI guy who works in a bank. And they go, we'll give him $2 million to give back to us. How nutty is this? So he goes to see his banker and they go, well, right. So he conjures up some notes for this company that's going to go out of business. There are a lot of options. So I'll sell you this paper for $2 million and just give it to that guy and I'm going to get $20 million in 2 weeks. It's all nonsense. And then when they had the whole, they recorded hours of conversations, all this stuff. He really did hardly anything wrong. And then they sat him down in a room, and then they brought out a suitcase, and they opened it up with a bunch of cocaine in it, or heroin, or what? It must have been cocaine.
I think it was cocaine. Yeah.
And he wasn't buying cocaine or selling cocaine. He was giving somebody $2 million that was going to help finance some deal. But just for the drama, the theatrics of it, they brought in a big suitcase of cocaine and opened it up, and they put it in his lap. And he, like, reached out and touched it. He goes, oh, yeah. Like, nervously touched it just so, like, I don't want to die and I want to get my $20 million. And that was, like, the big cornerstone of their case, that he was had the suitcase of cocaine, which is total theater. And he got acquitted. He got off. But then they started looking at his finances, and they found out he stole $17 million worth of investor money. He was like a total crook and scumbag. And then, like,
they just had it in for him.
But he was also
a crook.
Yeah. He was a crook. But then 2 days later, the model wife, I'm out of here, divorces him. I thought it was such a fascinating story in so many different ways. Like, you know, this one, she was measuring his genetic superiority. She's like 6'3".
But despite the implant, good chin, the chin implant.
She's like, good chin. He's 6'3". He's a business leader. He's so financially successful. Brilliant. And then, oh, wait a minute. Not that financially successful.
He's a crook. It's a fake chin.
I'm not in love anymore. For some reason, I'm not in love anymore. Out.
Who would think that of a supermodel? Of a 70s supermodel.
Dan, I think anybody would act that way, but it's very funny. A fascinating story, I thought. But that's exactly what you're saying, where somebody took a big risk, it didn't work out.
Yeah. Right. Well, there's two. The one is the business risk, but then there's, like, I've always said this. We all raise kids. It was always for me. It's not always like do the right thing and be moral, but it's always like, just throw out, once someone says, hey, I know a way you can make $20 million that involves a cocaine deal, just be like, put the hammer down there. Be like, no, I'm out. And they're like, you can't get caught, blah, blah, blah. Like, I'm not listening. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I have one of these firm rules. I don't do cocaine deals. Sorry.
Yeah, exactly. Just like, you don't need that in your life, especially a guy who's like.
Here's the other thing, Dan. It seemed like money, if he didn't steal that $17 million, he wouldn't have needed it. Like, he would have kept the company going.
Right.
But he must have had some, like, astronomical burn rate with the model wife and everything, where they were just spending money.
I think I'm just not equipped for, like, the stress of this stuff. Where, like,
so crazy. Yeah. Right?
I might have. I don't know if this is too. I don't know if I should. But, like, sort of a parallel thing. I just remember, because people always talk about, like, the peer pressure of, like, drugs and any corruption you can think of. But I was coming up on my engagement. I was going to be engaged to be married.
Right.
And someone I knew at the time was like, I'll skip the details of the story because it's a little sketchy. But, like, they were basically like, started talking to me. They're like, hey, have you tried heroin? And I'm like, so what happened was, I was like, I can't go out tonight. I got to get up early and I don't want to be hungover and something like that. And he goes, the way he approached it was like, I know a way you could not be hungover and still have fun. And I'm like, I am. And I realized what he's getting at. And I'm like, are you offering me heroin? Like, is that where it suddenly dawned on me what he was.
Yeah.
He's like, well, I'm just saying it would be, you know, blah, blah, no hangover. And
it's got a lot of benefits.
And I'm like,
a lot of upside.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, do you think this is a good time in my life as my engagement approaches and I'm getting my doctorate. Do you think a heroin habit would be like something I should start right now?
Dan,
like,
Dan, if everyone thought that way, there would be no heroin addicts. Come on.
Yeah, I know exactly. I know. I was not helping the heroin addict community, but, like, it was sort of like, what do you? So two things. One is, it's like, I always told my kid, like, this idea of, like, the pressure. It's like sort of how you see it too, because I was like, this is no pressure at all. I was laughing. I was like,
oh, right.
I was like, it's how you interpret the pressure in your mind. Cause I was like, oh, I'm not doing heroin. Get out of here. Like, it wasn't like, oh, this is so tense.
Well, I think the peer pressure is about esteem, where if I don't go along, I'm going to lose the esteem of my peers and my comrades here. That's you obviously weren't worried about losing the esteem of this.
I had no esteem for him. So I was, So, but it's a good point though, about esteem. Like, if you don't, why are you valuing it? Why are you so worried about what these people think, you know? But at the same time, I also, you know, it's like the broader topic, like, that we were talking about with your example, is that once someone breaches a certain norm, like, you know what we can do? We can, like, I remember as a little kid, you know, it was sort of like, you know, if we get up at 3 a.m. and sneak out of our houses, we can get into the junior high, you know, the middle school, and erase all our grades for that test we just, and it's like, like, you have to have some level where you're like, I'm going to give a hard no on that. Like, you know, like, and I think this is a broad skill in life to just be like, once you start hearing advice that you know, everyone knows deep down.
Well, Dan, you know,
once you're told, like, let's rob this, let's steal this, like, everyone knows 99% point something percent of people know, like, I shouldn't do it. And they end up just doing it. Like, happened?
Here it is, Dan. You value reality. You value what some would call a realistic interpretation of the world. We talked about that before. Yeah. Where these people get in trouble is they don't. So they delude themselves a little bit about seemingly harmless things. And once you start going down that path of delusion, it's easier to delude yourself about more and more.
Yeah, it's not a movie.
Once you start deluding yourself about your chin, I have a real big chin. Yeah. You get the chin implant and you get the other stuff. You start deluding yourself about stuff, then you can start doing cocaine deals.
Right.
So I think that's a cautionary tale. Take a realistic view on the world.
Yeah, just get out.
So here it was, Dan. June 2018, I sat down with my son, said, I got to get out of this ego trap. And my son really helps me in
this
a lot of
near,
things.
This is near, right around the beginning of this podcast, right?
I think it might be.
So our loyal listeners have been with us through the whole journey.
Our tribe has been with us through the journey. So I sat down with my son and we came up with a plan to break out of the ego trap. I think of the ego trap as this like 3-foot-high iron cage that I'm in where you can't stand up, and even if you sit down you really don't feel that comfortable.
And most people don't even consciously notice they're in it, I would say. Like I think maybe. Most people don't think through, I'm stuck in this ego trap, where people think I'm, it's more subtle than that, right? I think you're right.
And I listened to Dr. Doug Lyle on the Beat Your Genes podcast, and he explains what an ego trap is. I think our tribe probably knows what it is now. We've talked about it enough. But once you intellectually wrap your head around it, Dan, you're right. That's a key step in getting out of it, because you realize, oh, this is some kind of psychological dynamic that's happening that I can get out of if I just frame it differently and change some things, I can get out of this. So,
and two more quick points about egos. Yeah. One is, a lot of people listening might be like, well, I'm not in it. I'm not John Connor saying I'm awesome at jiu-jitsu. I don't think I'm awesome at jiu-jitsu, but there's lesser versions of it, right?
Well, here's the other thing. Like, I have to stop you right there. It's not even that you think you're excellent at it. It's what you think the other people think.
Right.
The problem is you don't think you're that excellent. You think you're good, but okay. But everyone else thinks I'm good. So that's the problem. Yeah.
But I think even there's a lot of people even listening that are like, well, no one thinks I'm that good. But it's like, but you can still be stuck because you're like, I still don't want to get tapped by blue belts or white belts or whatever the level is. It doesn't have to be like, no one can tap me. It can be like, I'm stuck at some level of this.
And it applies to everything.
That's the other thing I was going to say.
Kids in their schoolwork. It happens anywhere in life where you feel like you're being overvalued by other people. Yeah.
Yeah. It could be our personality, like he's really sociable and you're like, I don't feel that sociable, or he's really likable, or he or she is really good at this, at you know, hosting a party, going to a party, or like he's good at hooking up with women, or he's, or a million, you know, you could think of a million things. That's your point, right? It can be like, he or she is very funny, and then you're like, oh, I don't know if I'm that funny, or you know what I mean? Like,
right.
A million different things where you feel stuck.
That's it. So, Dan, here's the scheme, the structure we thought of to break out of the ego trap. So, first of all, we said, I'm going to train through the rest of 2018. So, for 6 months, we'll do competition-style training. Let's get ready to compete.
Can I say one quick initial thing? Isn't it even prior to that, the very first thing has to be, I'm willing to take this risk, right? I'm willing to lose.
Right, to get out of the ego trap. So one of the prime results of an ego trap is you shy away from competition. You stop competing. So to get out of an ego trap, you have to compete. I mean, that's got to be some element of it. That's just essential. You know what I mean?
So, and compete could be broader too. Like you said, if everyone thinks you're smart and you think I'm going to look, you have to
Put yourself out there.
Put yourself out there.
Yes.
And a very real result might be you don't look as good or
right.
you know, you lose.
Right. Right. Yeah, you could lose esteem by the people in your life.
So that's step one. Before you even say, I'm going to join these tournaments, you're like, I could lose a tournament. I could.
Yeah.
Right.
I have to put myself out there. I have to compete. I can't just train and say, I'm going to get out of the ego trap. No. The definition of being in the ego trap is you're avoiding competition.
Right.
So,
and I also just really quickly, for your example, I think it's worth noting that I'll put it as a question. You're not sort of sitting there smugly thinking, I'm going to beat all these guys.
Like, not at all.
You know what I mean? You're not like, I know I'm actually just going to win all these things.
I had no idea. Yeah. I was in the complete darkness with how I would do. So So the initial plan, I think this is important, Dan. I'm going to train for 6 months, and then I'm going to compete in 4 very prestigious tournaments in 2019. So why prestigious tournaments? Because if you lose in a prestigious tournament, then the potential loss of esteem isn't as bad.
Right.
You know what I mean? We're going to really shoot for the stars. So if we don't get there, it's going to mitigate the pain of the so-called loss of esteem. So that was the initial plan. So we started training, and I felt really good. And my son and I said, well, let's compete sooner. Let's go compete in September of 2018 at the Pan Ams in New York. So that's where I competed for the first time after 18 and a half years. And I had one match against a super seasoned, really excellent competitor. I got by him. Luckily, I didn't look up his pedigree before I competed against him because he's won so many tournaments. And we were off and running. And then we stuck with the plan. And then I went to the Nogi Worlds in December 2018. So we're way ahead of schedule now. I got a silver medal there.
In an extremely close match. Like it should,
in a close match.
It's relevant because it wasn't like you got destroyed.
No. Right? Yeah. So I quickly realized that. And what I really wanted to know is, can I compete with these guys at my age? And I found out I could compete. So that felt great. So then we were off and running. And then what did we do next? So then I picked up a larger challenge, believe it or not. I competed locally at the Boston Open. So why was that a bigger challenge? Because it was a less prestigious tournament.
More to lose.
More local people looking at me. More potential loss of esteem. So my son is the one that challenged me to do that. We were sitting in the gym one day, and he said, you should do the Boston Open. And Dan, I had a stress response. Whoop!
Even just sitting on your couch, you...
I was sitting on the mats of the gym with my son and a couple other guys. I think Steve Cherney, maybe somebody else. And my son said, you should do the Boston Open, just like that. And boop, I had a stress response just as the words hit my ears. Bam. I was like, shit, I don't want to do this, but I have to do it. God damn it. And if he had not said that, I would definitely not have done it.
Right.
And he said it, and then I had to do it. It was painful, a lot of anxiety. But I learned a lot. I came up with a couple new methods I stumbled upon to deal with the anxiety, and I dealt with it well, and I had a good performance. And then we did, I think we did the Gi World Championships, Masters Worlds.
Quick interjection, because I remember I just had a quick memory of the Boston Open, which also gets into your mindset, or the mindset of someone getting out versus someone observing.
Yeah.
That there was a brief exchange of someone saying about you, like, like I think someone spoke to Rory and was like, oh, your dad's going to win. Like, we know.
I think so.
But the important point is that you weren't thinking that way. Like, do you know what I mean? Like,
I didn't know what was going to
happen. From outside can think like John's just sort of swaggering through this. He knows he's going to win, but that's not where your head was, right?
No, it
was
not at all. And then, so then we did the Gi Masters Worlds in Vegas, and I got a silver medal, but I lost in the finals in that wacky match where I was ahead by an advantage point when time ran out. The ref gave the other guy an advantage, and then the ref gave him the decision. So at about this point, or somewhere around here, Dan, we really started focusing on the process of a long-term goal. So my long-term goal was to get a world championship in the Masters level. And we started focusing more on process, and things really started to come together. The training, I think, improved. Everything was better. And then that helped dealing with anxiety when it came to competing, because we were always looking at the distance. Each tournament, like the Boston Open, why did I do the Boston Open? It's going to get me a little bit closer to that long-term goal of being world champion. If I do this, is it going to bring me closer to the goal or further away? Definitely closer. So that started impacting my decisions of what to do and how to train. We had that t-shirt. What would a world champion do?
And you had great consistency, as we spoke earlier. There wasn't long periods of no training.
Oh, no. We trained twice a day, many days, most days, twice a day. And very focused training, and with that idea of so when I didn't win in August, I didn't feel that bad, because it's like, that's fine. I want to win.
Right.
And here's the other thing, Dan. I really wanted to win because I'm better than everybody. So hear me out with this. Right. I think we have this idea in our American culture that it's like Rocky Balboa, where you're going to actually be the underdog. You're going to be not as good as your opponent.
And pull it off.
And that day, you're going to pull it off somehow. And I think that's okay. But I think a better approach is sort of like what the New England Patriots do. We're going to build a system and a process that's going to make us so much better than everyone else. We're going to win.
Right.
And that's all there is to it. So I think it's a little bit of a paradox there, but I think if you focus on building a system and a process that's going to make you overwhelmingly better, that's the best idea. And then, of course, in the moment, you want to bring all you can bring to any competition.
So when was the European Championship?
I think, was in October. So we went over, we did that to Italy, and then I double golded there. So I won in my division, and I won in the open weight, which is, I hadn't done that yet. So that was exciting. And that was like another step forward in progress, competing in the open weight. So now I started getting some momentum. We came back in September of 2019, a year from the initial start of this whole competition project. And then I won gold again at Pan Ams. And then, so that was September Pan Ams. October was in Italy. And then December. So then we go out to Anaheim again. And this time, I had a bye in the first round, Dan, so I didn't have to compete in the first round.
How was your mindset? How was your anxiety compared to a year ago?
Way less anxiety, not even close. Yeah. A little bit of nervousness, but nothing like I used to have. So I've definitely developed my whole nervous system. Mm-hmm. And confidence, people talk about confidence, but it's, for the most part, confidence is domain specific. You know what I mean? So you're confident at writing or podcasting or whatever the hell it is. That's really where confidence comes in. You get confidence from experience. You go out and try something. You calibrate where you fit in. So now I have all these experiences where I'm like, yeah, I'm pretty good. I got a shot.
There's a quick good point where people say he's confident or she's confident or she's not confident. And it's like, well, it depends completely on what.
Right.
It depends completely.
And it's really, I mean, maybe some people can conjure it up out of thin air, but the best confidence is based on facts, based on experiences, you know? So I had a lot of experiences. So actually, when I looked at this tournament on paper, I think I was the favorite to win my division. So
that's my next question. You knew the people you were competing against?
I've seen the people,
Of them?
Yeah. You can see video of people too.
Oh, but were they the people like you competed against last year?
I competed against two of the guys before.
Okay.
And I've seen video of the other guys. So I think I'm not being obnoxious to say I was likely the favorite to win. And I was technically the number two seed.
Right.
I've never competed against the number one seed, but I think I would win that match most of the time. So, which now I kind of was back in the ego trap because I'm the favorite, but I didn't feel that much pressure from it. And this was interesting, Dan, because I didn't want to get too caught up in the moment. You know what I mean? I'm like, wait a minute. What has served me through this whole year and a half? What served me is looking into the distance, focusing on process, building the system to become a world champion. And I want to keep focusing on that. I don't want to focus too much on the moment here. I don't want to get like too grabby. Like, here's my chance. I got to grab it right now and get overexcited.
It's more grappling than grappling.
More grappling than grappling. Exactly. Okay. So I just want to stay the course with what I'm doing. You know what I mean? I don't want to get overly excited right here in the moment. And if I do that, if I keep doing what I've been doing, I should win. So why change? And if I don't win, that doesn't matter because I'm still looking at the distance winning a world championship. So I got a bye in the first round. That put me in the semis right away. So in that match, I ended up cracking skulls with this guy, and I cut this big gash in my head.
So for the people not watching the video, and I really think for the full experience, you should both listen audio and visual. at least two listens to each podcast. But, you know, you don't have to. But if you don't see it, John's got a pretty big gash over his eyebrow. But that's fine because you're going to probably get cosmetic surgery.
Right. I get a chin implant.
While you get the chin, you'll get that fixed up, get the cheekbones.
Yeah.
You're going to look fantastic.
Yeah. So the EMTs come in. There's blood everywhere. They clean it all up, wipe us all down off of the blood. They bandage it up.
So what hit you? Sorry.
The other guy's head.
Oh.
So the other guy was kind of, you know, jumping around out there. I wanted to shoot. I wanted to get my single leg takedown. And this guy was, it's different than wrestling. In wrestling, you basically have to come forward. And in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, you don't. And I was on the main mat, one of the main mats, which is larger. So it's this big, large competition area.
And he's dancing around.
And one of the great things is like Cyborg Abreu, world champion. He's competing on that same mat. So it's kind of exciting, you know? Yeah, he's kind of bouncing all around. And then I'm thinking to myself, as soon as this guy gets near me, I'm taking him down. He gets near me. And I changed levels, and bong, he did the same thing at the same time. So the top of his head blasts me in the forehead and splits me open. There's blood everywhere. So they come out, EMTs come out, they clean it all up, they bandage it up, and then they tape it up. And so you might have saw the pictures.
Yeah,
it looked like
had
Rambo in First Blood.
So that's also the explanation for people who don't know why you had a headband.
Right. And I will say this, Dan. I don't know if you have this experience. There's so many times in my life, it's like this cartoonish motif where you have a devil on one shoulder and an angel on the other shoulder. Do you ever feel that in life?
It's mostly the devils. But
exactly.
I know what you're saying.
So the ENT goes, do you want to continue? And I go, do I want to continue? Oh, maybe I can't. So now the devil's going, maybe you can't continue. And it's, you know what, Dan? If I didn't continue, it would have been perfectly reasonable. Right. I smashed my head open.
You absolutely have to.
Need like six stitches.
I've seen that with many matches where people bow out, and I'm just like, you can't. I just don't think I could ever do it. I think my brain would scream at me to bow out. I don't have this. Some people would never consider it. Probably Tyler would just be like, I don't consider it at all. I would consider it for sure, but I'd be like, I can't.
I know,
but
what I'm saying is I have these two voices on each shoulder. And I'm like, oh, maybe I shouldn't. And then I go to the guy, can I continue? And he goes, maybe. And I go, I'm like, yeah, I should continue. Yeah. And my competitor is like, you're right. You sure you can continue? And I'm like, yeah. So, but I was a little bit off my game after that. So then I'm like, well, I don't want to shoot again and crack my skull again. But
you don't have stitches, do you?
I should have got stitches, Dan.
It looks like you could have 10, 12 stitches.
I think at least six stitches probably.
Okay.
But I wanted to go out and celebrate. So I just went back to the hotel room, and Steve Cherney and Sean Newell put their military skills to work and like glued and butterfly stitched my head together. Sure. Yeah. So I win that match. Very close match. I barely win it.
Points?
Yep.
Okay.
Or advantages or something. I didn't perform well at all, Dan. I'm not happy with the performance, but I won.
Yeah, your head was also split open.
I won. I eked it out. So then they're like, are you going to keep going? They keep asking me.
Yeah.
So I got that stupid devil on my shoulder going, yeah, maybe you shouldn't continue. Well, you get a silver medal and you can come back next year and whatever. And then my son says to me, my son is such a good coach. And he said, so I used to say this thing back in the day. I started saying it to Jesse McGillicott and Matt Tullis, where sometimes if you have a fight or you have some competition coming up, somewhere along the line before you can compete, you hear some sort of negative news like, oh, the guy came in 5 pounds overweight.
Right.
And so the phrase we came up with was even better. we would say even better, which means the victory is going to be even sweeter, even better. I think Jocko Willink has something like, he uses some phrase, I think mine's better, even better. His is like, okay, or something like that. I think
yours is better.
Mine is superior.
It's definitely even better.
Even better. Yep. So my son said that. He somehow remembered that and pulled it out. He goes, even better when you win this with this cut on your head. I was like, right, even better. So it was great to have him. Yeah. So then in the finals, the guy came out. I think the guy saw that I had a cut, so he thought I might be weakened, and he came out really strong. And we did a lot of wrestling on our feet, hard wrestling. And then somewhere along the line, I just felt like I started getting the upper hand, and I snapped him down. I almost got it back control, but I screwed it up. And then he was in my guard. But at that point, I was completely committed and convicted to winning. And I said, I'm sweeping this guy, man. And I just grabbed hold of him, and I butterfly swept him. I could have went to mount, but I thought I would just take half guard to solidify my points, because no points had been scored yet. So then I was up 2-0. And then he tried to Kimura me. I ripped my arm out, got out of that. Then he started to get his guard back then. He started doing like a rubber guard or something like that. And I just powered through that. And then he got up on his elbow from bottom half guard. And I got around his back and I got control of his wrist. You know how Khabib does that sometimes? Yeah. It's a great grip. Once you get that, the guy on bottom is like really stuck until he can free that grip. And I didn't let him free it. And I ended up transitioning to his back, and I started to choke him. And I just had one hand in because I was controlling the wrist. And then I put my head forward, and I started realizing, oh, I think this choke is really having an effect. And then I finally got him flat to his stomach where I felt secure enough to let go of the wrist. And I went wrist over wrist to the rear naked choke. And he tapped with like 1 second left in the match, which Dan, it seems like it doesn't matter because I was up on points anyways, but it's so satisfying when you get that, especially the rear naked choke submission, you know, it's just so satisfying.
That's satisfying, right? Because without the tap, it's sort of like, if the guy could maybe, if I had another couple minutes.
That's the beauty of tapping. When your opponent taps, your opponent is saying you win.
Right.
The ref's not saying you win. The scorekeeper's not saying you win. You're not saying you win. Your competitor is saying, you know what? You win.
Right.
And it's as unequivocal as anything, right? That's just it.
Right.
So it's so good. And I had a lot of emotion right then. I felt like crying. It was so awesome. Yeah. And
you felt like crying.
I felt like crying. No crying.
Okay. Just checking.
Yeah. For a brief moment, I felt like crying. Yeah, for a split second. Let's be honest.
Felt like crying. That's like the guy's version of being emotional.
I was very emotional.
I would have cried.
I think I might have put my hand to my forehead. I know I was being a little histrionic. Well,
18-month or 18-year journey.
Yeah, I think you could call it a 20-year journey, Dan. I think it's safe to say that. Yeah. So it was great.
And so to be clear, if it's not clear to everyone, that's a world champion.
I am world champion, Master 6 Black Belt world champion.
Right.
2019. And I always will be.
Yeah.
So it's a great feeling, man. Yeah.
Right.
Very good feeling. Yeah.
So I think that there's more nuance to talk about this, but we're running pretty late.
We're running late. Yeah. So I'm glad I got through it.
Yeah.
So I think we covered
it. And of course, congratulations from me. And I speak for the rest of our podcast tribe saying huge congratulations.
Thank you. I also want to say congratulations to Maria Kiprio. She got a silver medal in her first ever world championship competition. She performed amazing.
Congratulations to Maria.
And my son did great. Well, Steve Cherney is the man. Sean Newell was out there with us too. He's a great guy.
Yeah, all these people are awesome competitors.
And that's it, Dan. So I hope I wasn't too long-winded with that. Yeah. And folks, be a member of the tribe. Share, rate, and review this. Yeah. Tell your friends about
it. It's a big moment. Now you can tell your friends, do you want to hear a podcast? One of the guys is a world champion.
World champion, right.
And the kid. World champion and the kid.
World champion, grabbler, and the kid.
Yeah.
That's going to be the new name of the podcast. Awesome. All right, folks. Thanks. We'll talk to you next week.